Tonight, we are going to present about the Eightfold Path. So as we go along, I'm going to just keep the participants' window open so that I can see if you raise your hands, if you have any questions. Please do ask questions as you go along. As we go along, if you have a question, please raise your digital hand at any time, and I'll find a time to respond to it. And we'll also have other times in the course of this presentation to ask questions. So last week, Lori gave the Saturday talk on the Four Noble Truths. It was a really good talk. And I want to review those very briefly. And she also gave a kind of introduction to the Eightfold Path. And we're going to take that more deeply tonight. So the Four Noble Truths actually echo an ancient Indian medical model, which makes a lot of sense when you think about it. It's the first truth of dukkha is disease. And actually, one of the translations for dukkha is dis-ease or unease. But in this medical model, it's disease. And you have the second noble truth, which is the cause of the disease, which is, to our understanding now, it's bacteria or a virus or some other condition. In Buddhist terms, it's craving, desire, wanting things to be different from how they are. The third noble truth is that there is such a thing as being healthy in this medical model, to be free of disease. And in the Buddhist version of this, the third noble truth is the truth of Nibbana. There is an end to suffering. And the fourth noble truth in the medical model is the cure. And in Buddhist terms, it is marga or magga, the path to Nibbana. And it is the Eightfold Path, which we're going to be speaking of today. I would suggest also that in the context of our lives, we can use the Four Noble Truths as an analytical tool. And you can think of that in social terms or in personal terms. It's the truth of the first truth is the truth of suffering, which is what is our experience at this moment, and just to say in the Dhammacakkappavattara Sutra, which is the sutra of the first turning of the wheel, the Buddha said, this is the noble truth of dukkha. Birth is dukkha, aging is dukkha, sickness is dukkha, death is dukkha, sorrow and lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are dukkha. Association with what one doesn't love or unpleasant conditions is dukkha. Separation from what we love or separation from pleasant conditions is dukkha. Not to get what one wants is dukkha. And then it sums up, and we'll get to this later in in our classes, the five aggregates of attachment, which is the five skandhas, are dukkha. And the second noble truth is the noble truth of the origin of dukkha, which is craving, which produces rebirth, which is bound up with pleasure and greed. It finds delight in this and that. And in other words, craving for sense pleasures, craving for existence or becoming, and craving for non-existence or annihilation. I think there's other ways that we can frame the cause of dukkha. It's useful to frame it as wanting things to be different from how they are. And another way to frame it is that emotional reactivity is dukkha. That not emotion, but our reaction to emotion is suffering. So those are the first two noble truths. The third noble truth is the truth of nirvana, or the truth of cessation of dukkha. And in the Dhammacakkappavattara Sutra, the Buddha says, it is the complete cessation of dukkha, giving up, renouncing, relinquishing, detaching from craving. Achan Amaro, one of our Western Theravada teaching, says that he has a wonderful way of putting cessation. It's like when you're lying in bed and the refrigerator switches off. You know, that kind of droning sound that you hardly notice at all. And yet when it switches off, it's like, ah. That's literally cessation. It's the cessation of that sound, which you didn't even know was causing you some uneasiness. So that's a wonderful analogy for cessation. And so then we come to the fourth noble truth. The fourth noble truth, simply put, is I want to just to name them all. The Eightfold Path, it's the Eightfold Path, which is the path, the way, the path to the cessation of suffering, the way we can accomplish the end of nibbana, the end, which is nibbana. So those eight steps on the path are right view, right understanding, right thought, or right intention, or right aspiration, right speech, which includes right listening, right action, right livelihood. And then there is the right effort, which pertains to the field of meditation. So it's the right effort in our practice. The right awareness, right mindfulness, which is actually a tool that applies to almost all of these. And then right meditation or right concentration. And we will go into all of these. So this These eight steps break down into three areas. The first area, Lori talked about this actually in her talk, and she had an interesting way of putting it. Whoops. Lori put it as the first two, right view and right intention, are our attitude, the attitude that we have towards life. The next three which is right speech, right action, and right livelihood, are the area of conduct or moral behavior. And then she said that the third is meditation, which is commonly the way it's framed. And that consists of right effort, right awareness, and right meditation. Or right concentration. Again, one of our Theravada teachers talks about the Eightfold Path as a way to return to integrity. And so you have attitude is another way of expressing prajna or wisdom. And in terms of a physical model, that is the area of our head. Sila, which is the attitude, which is the expression of conduct or morality, is Sila, precept, and that is synonymous with our body. And then Samadhi, which is technically means concentration, but more broadly means meditation, is the heart. So we have the head, the body, and the heart as creating the integrity of our whole physical being. So these are not stages. These steps are not stages, but they're all arising and being practiced as appropriate in any given moment. And also they have a circular movement or circular route which supports and amplifies each other. I think Lori said this also on Saturday, that in a sense, the first two steps of right view and right intention, which are the wisdom steps on this path, are actually the precondition for morality and the precondition for meditation. And so morality and meditation, in turn, further cultivate or nurture the ground of wisdom. What's interesting to me as I was thinking about it this week is that this is resonant with Dogen's expression of practice realization. In our framing of the Zen that we practice, coming from Dogen, we understand that we don't practice realization, we don't practice meditation in order to become enlightened. We practice meditation as an expression of our already enlightened nature. So in this sense, with wisdom as the ground in the first two steps of the noble of the Eightfold Path, morality or ethical conduct and meditation are the expression of the wisdom that we already have. So it's really synonymous with Dogen's notion of practice enlightenment. So the other thing I want to say about this before I want to stop and take some questions, but all of these steps of the Eightfold Path are the word right is attached to them. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, and so forth. Right means, in this context, right means normal or natural. That's who we are when our habits and our self-regarding patterns are set aside. We think and we act from the place of oneness, then that is what we might think of as right. So as we've been thinking about this, all of our Buddhist practices, all those lists, the factors of enlightenment, the paramitas, the precepts, the Eightfold Path, and so forth, are these, they're all, in a sense, they are virtues. They are expressions of the enlightened activity of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, the natural expression of them. It's right, natural, and normal. And at the same time, for those of us who are somewhat deficient in the realization of our Buddha nature, they are practices to be cultivated that lean or that lead to the realization of our Buddha nature, the realization of ourselves as bodhisattvas. So for a bodhisattva or a Buddha, the Eightfold Path is just natural activity. That's what they do. They don't have to think about it. They just do that. For us who are still on the path to becoming bodhisattvas, these are actually practices that we have to cultivate. So I want to stop there and see if you have any thoughts or questions, and just take a breath, and please raise your digital hand, and we'll stop for a moment and address that. So please feel free to ask questions. I see a question from Kelsey.
Hi, Hozan.
Hi.
I am curious if right is normal and natural in this context, is there a wrong?
Yes. There is a wrong.
Is that unnatural?
What?
Is that unnatural?
It's unnatural. What it is deluded. Wrong is a self-centered view. Wrong proceeds from the view of oneself as a self that has an interest and has a self-concern, and all of our deluded behavior proceed from that. We'll talk about that a little more, but yes, this is the choices that we have are quite simply put, the right effort is actually where this applied. Right effort is proceeding from vow, proceeding from the bodhisattva vow, proceeding from the vow to wake up. And wrong, if you will, is to allow ourselves to be pulled around or pushed around by our habits and our karma. Does that make sense? And, you know, in early Buddhism, it's very unambiguous. Something is wholesome or something is unwholesome. And it's easy to discern that. In Mahayana Buddhism, and I think in Zen, which is Mahayana Buddhism, it gets a little more complicated, because what is a wholesome intention on a conscious level, if we are not bodhisattvas or Buddhas, may actually have elements of the outcome that are unwholesome. And so this is something that we can talk about and investigate further. But I think you find, generally, my sense is that early Buddhism is quite unambiguous. And Mahayana Buddhism looks to, it still is, there's clear, it's clear about what's right and what's wrong, but it's not clear about what's right and what's wrong in every situation, because those situations are themselves highly conditioned. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it's bringing up for me sort of what is actually a self-centered action. Thinking about, like, am I doing this to take care of myself in a non-selfish way? Or am I doing this to take care of myself in a very self-serving way, or, you know, something like that?
Well, I think that this calls for us to really scrutinize our thoughts and our actions very closely, which is actually the heart of the practice. And another way to examine or explore this is to ask our friends and teachers. You know, we are capable, because we are karmic beings, we are capable of deluding ourselves. And that's why we have good Dharma friends and teachers to reflect what something looks like. Good, thank you. Sean?
Hi, I think that you, I have kind of the same question, and you may have covered it, but I got a little distracted while I was trying to compose my question. And so the word natural always kind of throws me off because it always raises a red flag when I see it on foods. And that label, you know, you can see things from the 40s back in the old days, you know, natural food. And it was, and I think, you know, it was intentionally deceptive. It seems that way. So I just got a little thrown off. And what is natural? You know, and I think it does tie into something about, you know, are our actions self-centered, or, you know, are we trying to take care of ourselves? Are we, you know, recognizing something in ourselves that's not quite right? And so we're paying a lot of attention to ourselves. So maybe you could just touch on the word natural just a little bit.
I didn't say organic. Natural to me implies, well, to go back, it's interesting. In the context of Christianity, which most of us have in our background, whether we're Christian or not, but in growing up in this country, we have the notion of original sin, right? I think that Buddhism has the notion of original enlightenment. That is what is natural. What is natural is that the way of being that is not conditioned by karma. So, and I'm going to get into that in the next section. But that's what I'm using as a rough guide to natural.
Okay. Yep.
Yeah. Joe?
Hello. Yes. I was thinking, is this like the notion of tzedakah?
Which is what?
Righteousness from the rabbinic from Jewish tradition.
Yes. Okay. I thought that's what the reference was. Perhaps so. I get tangled up myself, coming from a Jewish background. I have all kinds of karmic formations about that. So, but I think that there certainly is a notion of what is wholesome and what is unwholesome that is very clearly defined in actually all of the traditions of the book. And there is probably there's resonance there. Maybe I should leave it there. Is that okay? Okay, anything else before I proceed? Any other questions or thoughts? So there are the path, Marga, has two dimensions, which is really in a way it's a reference to the two truths in Buddhism. There's the mundane truth, there's a mundane path, and there's the supra mundane truth, or the there's conventional and there is transcendent. There's mundane, supra mundane. And the noble, the four, the Eightfold Path can be seen in each of those contexts. So the mundane path is actually what we are following when we try to really attend to the circumstances of our life. And what I like about the Eightfold Path, you know, the Eightfold Path is the path to the cessation of dukkha. It's the path to nirvana. But if you look at it, talking about your view, your thought, your speech, your action, your livelihood, which is your job, your effort in the various aspects of your meditation, this is the picture of a whole life. So in the mundane dimension of the path, it's a question of laying out standards for how each of us lives. And we find this actually mirrored. It's really mirrored in the Zen tradition in a wonderful way. Because in the Zen tradition, we have our meditation, we cook for ourselves, we serve for each other, we have work period, we return to meditation, we have elements of everyday life that are embedded in the form of our practice day. And monastic practice is exactly like that. You go from one of these activities to another without really distinguishing one. One is not higher than the other. Cooking, serving, work period are also expressions of right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. They are also the taste of the food that the Tenzo cooks, the way it is served into your plate, the way somebody cuts the grass or paints the house are also expressions of their wisdom, of their view and their intention. And so this is, to me, what is wonderful about the practice that we have is that completely expressive of the entire Eightfold Path. And it's different than, say, going on a meditation retreat where you're really ensconced in meditation, and then there's a staff that serves you, or that cooks the food and serves you. And there's no work period because the staff is actually doing the work. This is a very different, I don't mean to be critical, but this is a very different modality of practice than what I think we find in our tradition. And I think you find it in other traditions as well. So this is the mundane path is what happens when we try to clarify our discipline, clarify the practices that we do, which develop concentration and arouse day-to-day insight. Whether this is in our walking around lives or in our in sesshin or retreat. mundane doesn't necessarily mean worldly. In other words, it's not the cultivating the mundane Eightfold Path is not a road to wealth or fame or worldly success. The mundane path actually is a necessary path on the way to enlightenment. And in fact, we actually have to practice the mundane path before we reach the super mundane path. And I think we'll come to what the distinction is, but in the mundane path, it means that we are still seeing conditioned things. We are seeing things. We're seeing other people as things, we're seeing objects as things, and so forth. We're seeing conditioned things, and we are working with them as the substance of our lives, as a substance of our practice. The supramundane path is the directly seeing the reality of conditioning. It's not looking at the conditioning, the conditioned object, but it's seeing that everything we look at is subject to conditions. And when we see that conditionality, we are actually, by seeing that conditionality, we are having a glimpse of nirvana. You have to cultivate the mundane before you can have the insight into the super mundane. And in fact, one of the problems that can occur to someone in meditation is having a glimpse of conditionality, of the universal nature of conditionality, without having the grounding in the mundane, without having reached it by that path. So when we practice the mundane path, our understanding gets deeper and deeper. And sometimes when we have done that for a long time, then we have a glimpse, a radical shift in perspective, where we're seeing the nature of conditionality itself. And this is a kind of spiritual maturity. And when the mind turns to this way of looking at all that we see, then we are free from where, when we see conditionality, then we're not free from conditionality, but we're free within conditionality. So let me stop there for a moment and see if this provokes you in any way. Evidently, yes. Here's Ross.
Hey, Ozan. Good evening. What does that mean to be free from conditionality?
I'm sorry, you broke up.
What does it mean to you to be free within conditionality? We see it, but we're free from it, as opposed to being kind of bound or trapped or hooked.
I think it means we are freer to make choices that are in alignment with our vow to awaken with all beings. Otherwise, short of that, we're still going to be pulled by these subtle or not so subtle tugs of our habits and what we perceive as ourself.
So it sounds like the decisions or choice we make are still conditioned, but there's a different quality to the relationship. It's not like we're in like some kind of new world of unconditioned.
Well, I can't really say because I'm not there. But my understanding is that we're constantly turning towards the unconditioned. We're turning, say, when we take the Bodhisattva vow to awaken with all beings, we're awakening with all beings because we see that all beings are ourselves, that there is no separation between you and me. And so to work for that benefit, the benefit of all beings, is to work for my own liberation and your liberation.
So it sounds like we practice the ordinary, and then there's a realization that's actually extraordinary.
That's what the traditional teaching is saying. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
That is what it's saying. And I think that in the Zen tradition, you know, you've been studying Dogen for a long time. In the Zen tradition, what I feel like Dogen is saying and others are saying is that the transcendent, the supramundane, is there all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's everywhere. And even in, it's there even in what we see as conditioned. But we see it as conditioned because it's very hard to get free from our mind that sees this as conditioned.
Conditioned, exactly, yeah.
Right. So that's Yogacara teaching. Yogacara teaching is that everything that we see is a function of our perception.
Right.
And yet, it's also saying there's something beneath or beyond that that we can get a glimpse of.
Or within that, in line with what you're saying.
Right.
Great. Yeah. Thanks so much, Hozan.
Thank you. Judy?
Hi, Hozan. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
I realize I'm getting sort of lost in the sauce of language, especially these terms of the mundane and the super mundane, which just always land kind of abstract for me. And I realize that where it's landing in my body, you know, in my heart space, is reflecting on our recent council practice and the incredible intimacy and warmth that came forth in people sharing just 2 minutes each, what was alive for them in the moment, and how it covered just the spectrum of experience from just the whole range of human emotion and loss and joy and, you know, just everything. And that from that, somehow what emerged was a collective, seemed like shared recognition, shared intimacy, and, you know, love. And how important that was to me, that I really felt Sangha is something very real and alive. And so I'm wondering if there's a way to speak to this mundane and super mundane or conditioning or, you know, any of that stuff, that languaging that speaks to intimacy and relationship? Like, how do we really practice with this?
Well, I don't think there's really a distinction there between mundane and supramundane. That if we look at when we go through the Eightfold Path, which we're just about to do, when we talk about conduct, which is, of course, influenced, it's conduct is the expression of our wisdom. Conduct is also what grows out of, hopefully what grows out of our meditation. Conduct is completely about relationship. So right speech is about relationship. Right action is about relationship. Right livelihood is about relationship. These are the manifestations of our connection and our love. And they exist on the mundane and so-called the supramundane level. And this is, for me, these are themselves provisional descriptions. They are not absolute descriptions. I mean, of course, in the Zen tradition, we eschew steps and stages. What I'm giving you is an overview of a traditional perspective, and we have to figure out how that manifests in our practice. But it is about love. It's about connection. And I would say, as Kelsey was asking, you know, if there's wholesome, is there unwholesome? And I think it's a very simple distinction. Wholesome is about the cultivation of connection. And unwholesome is about the activity of division. And that is a simple framework, but so far it's worked for me. So I want to go into each one of these. Oh, there's another. Gary has a question.
Hi. Would you say that like during Sesshin, when kind of the bottom drops out, that, you know, periodically that happens once in a while, mm-hmm. Would you call that the super mundane versus?
Yeah, it's a glimpse of the super mundane.
Okay,
that's mundane. Yes.
Yes. Okay.
It's a, you know, I think that. At the risk of cliche or oversimplification, when that happens, we experience oneness. It's not that we think about it. It's not that we have an idea about it. We're actually just at one with all that we experience. So that's one way, and that can be a large cataclysmic experience. It can also be a very quiet, subtle experience. And the thing is, if we're really tuned into ourselves, if we do is we actually take our practice from the meditation hall into the world, and our practice being really looking at our minds, then we might see that actually that these experiences are not so unusual. So that's what I would say. Joel?
Yeah, thank you, Hossa. The supramundane. Like I say, the supramundane path, but so far I'm not clear about the pathness of the supramundane. It seems, like you say, to be one. So the one doesn't include eight, if that makes sense. Like I'm hearing specific times when we have a sense of that we, the bottom has fallen out, like at session. But maybe I'm getting hung up on the idea of path.
I think you are.
Yeah.
I'm looking for something here, 1 second.
Yeah.
These are not steps.
Yeah.
They're aspects, they're facets.
Okay.
So depending on what you're looking at, you may see one aspect or one component or another. They're not steps that are going step by step towards something.
Yeah. Well, they're aspects, but it would seem like, so the supramundane would appear in all, like in the livelihood. There it is. It drops out and you're in a livelihood context and there it would be. Or you're in a word, you're speaking and something opens up. I mean, that's harder for me to imagine.
Oh, because it's easy for me to imagine. Yeah, that happens.
Well, it happens when you or Mel or someone like just says this thing and wham.
Anyone.
Know? Yeah. So it's like the supramundane manifests in all these aspects.
Yes.
Okay, that helps. That helps.
And all of these aspects are manifestations of, at that point, they're manifestations of Nirvana. They're manifestations of an unself-centered being.
Okay.
I want to go on, if that's okay.
Sure.
And go through the Eightfold Path. So, by the way, I want to say, I think that, you know, there's an, in the Thich Nhat Hanh book, it's kind of extended. It goes on for a number of chapters, and it's very good. There's really good material there. And the best I can do is to allude to it, and you should read it, I think. So right view or right understanding is the true foundation. In a sense, it's the right view of the other stages of the path. In other contexts, the right view is the view of Nirvana. In one of, Dogen also talks about it, is right view is looking at the nature of impermanence. So it's not something that one reads in a book. Without right view, everything is really cloudy or unclear. It's also right view is not a particular view. What the way I've come to see it is right view is it can be a view of what is right in front of you, and that can be near or far, according to the demands of the circumstance. Right now, my right view is expressed by my view of the screen and my seeing of you. At another time, my right view for me might be looking at what is happening in Myanmar. Look at what is happening in Israel, Palestine, to recognize that that is also my world. And I have responsibility to it and for it. So right view is not a fixed focal length, if that makes sense. There's all kinds of formulations of right view. One is that right view is the recognition that a person is the owner of their karma, that nobody else owns your activities, but you do. And what you do in the world, what effect that has is dependent upon your activities. Another way is to look at right view as the view of the Four Noble Truths, that everything is subject to arising and everything is subject to ceasing. Thich Nhat Hanh talks about right view. When you look at a piece of paper, right view is the view that sees the tree, the sun, the soil, the rain, the paper mill worker, the person behind the counter at Office Depot. That right view is seeing the entirety of the amazingly complex reality that puts this piece of paper in front of me. And when you look at a piece of paper, right view is to see all of that conditionality. You also might say that right view is seeing that in our usual world, there is no single right view. That my right view of something is different than, say, Ron's or Karen's or Stan's. You know, that we see things differently and we don't even know exactly how differently we see things. But that our view is also conditioned on our karma, and that it's not an accurate, flawless mental representation of whatever it is that we're encountering. Right view, you could also say, Thich Nhat Hanh says that we look at the cause of suffering, and until we have right view, when we look at the cause of suffering, we tend to blame others for our unhappiness. That's a tough one. Because our world is completely interactive. And often, when, and even I hear myself when I say that, say, yes, but Thich Nhat Hanh's perspective is it's very tough-minded. So again, this comes back to owning one's own karma. When you own your, until one owns one's karma, one doesn't have the ability to change one's karma. And the reality of the Buddhist notion of karma, which is different than other, say, notions of karma in Indian religion, is that karma is not fixed. Karma can be transformed. And so another way of looking at right view is that it's the potentiality of change and of our agency in that change according to our vow. So right thought or right intention is comes from right view. And so it is right, right intention is the intention to be free. And I would say it's to be free on, you know, in the mundane dimension, it's to be free from the shackles of our society or the conditions that we've been subject to by virtue of birth, by virtue of language, skin color, gender, etc. And in the super mundane, it's to be free. And ultimately, and certainly in the early Buddhist tradition, it's to be free from the cycle of birth and death. Right intention is also connected to renunciation, the renouncing of self-gratification of our attachments. And the flip side of that, of renunciation, is right view is the view of generosity, of giving what we can to people with respect to what they need. Right view is loving kindness, it's compassion. And in the Mahayana tradition, it is the four vows. The Bodhisattva vows are right view. And to raise those vows, right view is to raise bodhicitta, to raise the mind that wishes for the awakening and enlightenment of all beings, which include ourselves. So those are the first two. Those are the wisdom aspects of the path. We move on to the conduct section, which is right speech, right action, and right livelihood. And I don't know, a lot of you have had lay ordination. Some of you not yet. And I wonder how many of you have had lay ordination, never read, you know, that long paragraph that's at the bottom of your Kechi Miyaku. good to take it out and read it. So one of the sections in Maikechi Miyaku says, the monk Hakuryu Sojin Daisho, in the inner room of Zen Shinji, which is at Tassahara, affirmed and revealed to me, Hozan Kushiki, that the perceptual vein of the Buddha is the one great causal condition of our lineage gate. In other words, the element of conduct, the element of the precepts, is the essential aspect of our lineage. You can put that in two ways. One way you could say, if we're not acting in alignment with wholesome conduct, then we are not manifesting right view and right intention. We're not manifesting wisdom. And then you can turn it on its head and say, if we are not embodying wisdom, then we're not going to be capable of the manifestation of right conduct. So it's a beautiful line that the perceptual vein, the preceptual vein of the Buddha is the one great causal condition of our lineage gate. So the first of these three, the third noble truth is right speech, which is put first in this section on conduct, because often speech leads our thought and our action. And also because, as we may have noticed, it has the greatest potential for wide-ranging harm. So right speech means not lying, not slandering or tale-telling, not being rude or indulging in harsh speech or idle talk. And again, to come back to what I was saying to Judy, right speech means words that unite and connect us rather than words that divide us. And one thing that I like about Thich Nhat Hanh's teachings is that the flip side of right speech, another necessary element, is listening. Instead of speaking, when we're not speaking, we should be listening. And I think that the ratio of speaking to listening should favor listening, although I'm doing a very poor job of it tonight because I'm supposed to speak. But listening, this is what the practice of counsel is about. It's mostly listening. If you have 20 people, you're going to listen to 19 of them, and you're going to speak once. So the percentage of listening to speaking is, very high. The fourth of the Eightfold Path is right action. And this covers a number of the 10 Bodhisattva precepts. But it means right action means promoting wholesome and honorable conduct. And it includes at least four precepts. It includes the precept of not killing, not stealing, not using intoxicants, and not misusing sexuality. And again, I would say right action means bringing people together, creating harmony, creating community, as opposed to creating dissension. The fifth noble truth is right livelihood, which means livelihood that sustains other beings and doesn't bring harm to them. So very particularly what's spelled out is not making or selling weapons, not selling intoxicants or drugs, not gambling or promoting gambling, not being a butcher, and so forth. That's right livelihood. And I think it's a delicate question these days, because there are many things that we do that are just a job. I remember there was a discussion at a Engaged Buddhist seminar where the presenter was talking about bringing mindfulness to the offices of Nike, sneaker company. And he went on and on, and just the question that came up, which got very short shrift in response, was, well, is mindfulness being offered to the factory workers in the Philippines? And also, is it rife livelihood to be making sneakers that cost $150? This is a difficult question. Some things are really clearly right livelihood, but some things are quite ambiguous, and we have to figure this out. Eiken Roshi told a story once about having a student who was really gung-ho for Zen practice. And he owned a liquor store. And he said, well, how should I think about this? And Eiken Roshi said, well, in a year, most likely either you will sell the liquor store or you will stop practicing. And, you know, he ended up not continuing his practice. Now, that's kind of anecdotal. But I think that in our world, the question of right livelihood is one that we have to examine really closely. It's a murky question, but it's still quite relevant. I'm aware of the time. The sixth step on the Eightfold Path is right effort or diligence. This simply means, not so simply, avoiding the unwholesome and cultivating the wholesome. And if you can figure out what those are by yourself, great. If you can't, then get help in contemplating them. Right effort also means, I mean, someone was speaking with me today about what should they be doing as practice. And I really take, to me, right effort is, Sojin Roshi spoke to this and said, right effort is just to set an intention and keep it. So if your intention is, if you say, I'm going to sit a period of Zazen on Tuesday, April 18th, if you keep it, that intention, that is right effort. If you don't, then that's not right effort. So we keep our practice, right? Effort means setting an intention, a realistic intention, and keeping it. And that's an intention to practice. That's also an intention of how we manifest our conduct in the world. How we provide our livelihood. All of that is a matter of right effort or diligence. The chapter on right, the seventh, on right mindfulness is the richest, I think, in Thich Nhat Hanh's book. And I'm not even going to go into it. It's really excellent and detailed. But for Thich Nhat Hanh, what he does is he takes right mindfulness and he has it as a bridge. He puts it up to the third step on the path because he feels that right mindfulness is the bridge between wisdom and those aspects of conduct and meditation. And I think that makes a lot of sense. And in that chapter, he outlines, he goes into I think it's the seven miracles of mindfulness, which he's written a whole book about, and also goes into the four foundations of mindfulness. Mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of the feelings, mindfulness of thoughts, and mindfulness of the dharmas. And I think that it's important to recognize when we talk about mindfulness, sometimes we really dumb it down to think of it as just being in the present. But it's being in the present in our body. It's being in the present in our feelings, which are, in Buddhist terms, the feelings are very simple. They're just bare perceptions of what's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Being in mindfulness, in mindful awareness of our thoughts, which are our thought formations. What stories are we telling? What are we making up about, built on our perceptions? What narratives are we creating about our lives and what they mean? What interpretations? And then the fourth foundation of mindfulness is mindfulness of the dharmas, which is a highly active practice. It's not just being in the present moment, it's actually applying the Eightfold Path to what we perceive. It's applying the paramitas as practices. It's applying the factors of enlightenment. So it's applying these dharma systems. It's like putting lenses in your glasses and looking at the world through those lenses. Which means actually affecting and changing our perception. And the eighth step on the Eightfold Path is right concentration or right meditation. And what's interesting, Thich Nhat Hanh talks about this as one-pointedness. But he also explains that the Chinese character for concentration has the implication of evenness. So of balance, of having a very even way of meeting one's mind. And I like that a lot. Because we can mistake concentration for something very intense. And the notion of concentration as evenness kind of takes the edge of accomplishment away. So concentration or that's our meditation. And our meditation, of course, involves it involves effort. It involves our sitting upright, which is effortful, and it involves mindfulness. Mindfulness is another translation of the word mindfulness. The correct translation is smriti, or sati, means remembering. So it's remembering where we are. And within our meditation, that's a constant effort that we are making. So those are, we've gone through the Eightfold Path here. There's more that I could say, but I'm going to stop because we're almost out of time. Leave the last minutes for questions and comments. Ross, I see your hand up.
Hello again, Hozan. Thank you. I have a question about right livelihood.
Yeah.
As you explained, it sounded like for me that BVC's Abbott and office manager are involved or engaged in right livelihood because they are supporting a practice for awakening in our Sangha. And at the same time, when I look at the screen, I'm wondering who will have a glass of wine at dinner, drink a beer, have a bottle of scotch for warming up in cold days and stuff like that, and are supporting liquor store owners or wine shops or what have you. How do we reconcile that as right or wrong, wholesome or unwholesome?
Yeah,
there's not a question about the, you know, the practice place livelihood, but most people are engaged in working in other places.
Yeah. I think it's good to leave that as an open question. So long as I'm going to have a glass of wine, it's a little hard for me to take a high moral stand towards the person who's selling me the wine. You know, I'm giving you the traditional interpretation here.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a glass of wine or I'll have a glass of bourbon. I'm not doing that to intoxicate myself, but I still have questions about doing it or not doing it. That's okay.
For yourself, but not the person.
For myself.
That's very different. To bring it back to me. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or oneself. Thank you.
Yeah. That's helpful. Okay. Sure. I think that's where I have to start. You know, if I'm saying that selling alcohol is not right livelihood, and I'm drinking alcohol or eating a hamburger, then there's a disconnect.
Right.
And
as you said, it should be, as you were telling Judy, it's something that's inclusive. So you're included with the liquor seller or the hamburger purveyor.
Right.
And not separating from it. Yeah.
Right.
Got you. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Other questions or thoughts? So it's a little bit like drinking from a fire hose here tonight, but I hope you'll excuse me. You can always go back and listen. So we do have a couple minutes, and if anyone has something to ask or to put forward, please. Sue.
This has been a real journey. I didn't get through all the Noble Eightfold Path in the book because it's so much material, and I actually haven't read this book before. So I want to thank you for giving us homework and your presentation tonight. Thank you very much. It's been quite a journey.
Good. Thank you.
And I look forward to future classes.
I think it's a very good book. And yeah, the Saturday class is going to be on the three marks of existence, the four marks of existence, however you want to contemplate it. And we're going to unpack that. It's not so complicated. It's not as complex as this, but it's important. Anyone else? Mary Beth? And then Ben? No, God.
What?
Mary Beth, and then Carol, and then Kelsey, and then probably we have to end.
This is just a quick question. I wasn't sure what the three marks of existence were in the book. Is that the same as the three Dharma seals?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, it's the three Dharma seals. Yeah. I will refrain from saying anything. Carol?
Do we have lots of lists in our practice?
Oh, yeah.
And some of them overlap.
Yes.
And so many, you know, I'll read and I'll say, these are the most important. I don't know, there's some feedback. I don't know if that's my machine. But, you know, this is the way to cross over to this shore, or this is if you want peace in your life. And what do you think is the most important of all these lists to really... You know, because it's hard to, seems like it's hard to follow them all, or to study them all and to really take them in, you know, one's body and mind and everything.
Yes, I always return to the Four Noble Truths, which of course includes the Eightfold Path. Four Noble Truths are really my touchstone. And because I can use them in the context of looking at meditation, and I use them as an analytical tool for circumstances that are problematic. You know, you can use them to look at social questions. You can use them to look at questions in your family or questions at work. You know, what is the suffering? What's hurting right now? Or what feels out of balance? What's the cause or the causes of it? And to look very widely at those causes. What would it look like for them to end? What would the appearance of harmony or peace look like, and how do you get there? And so that applies to us as individuals in the context of our meditation practice, but it also applies to communities, it applies to nations, it applies to work situations. So I go back to the Four Noble Truths because that's the first thing that the Buddha taught. And so that's like the point of departure to me. And it's common to every tradition of Buddhism that I know. All the rest is commentary. So last question, Kelsey.
I think I kind of answered this question myself, but I'll put it out there, which with right livelihood, I was kind of feeling, I feel there's like a judgment of other people's livelihoods that comes up. And then I started thinking, well, maybe there's a judgment of every single one of these parts of the path. And that's not really what we're concerned with, is if someone else has right view or right understanding or right livelihood. We're concerned about, do we have right view, right livelihood?
Yes, so this is actually a spin-off of your earlier question, right? And what I will say, and this is something that I discussed with Bhikkhu Bodhi. I think you might know of him as a really significant translator and scholar. And what he said was, early Buddhism, what he calls Theravada Buddhism, there was no ambiguity. Something was wholesome or unwholesome. It was quite binary. I don't think we see the world quite that way. And yet we still have to decide. I'm much more interested in the question in what I was saying to Judy, what connects and binds us and what divides us? And the problem there is that sometimes the same thing might connect some people and divide others. We have to decide what to do and live with the consequences. So it's not so binary. The presentation, I think you're right, that the way, even by the formulation of the application of the word right, there's this implication of this binary nature. So we have to figure out what right means for us. That's the best we can do. And the fact is we have a community. So we can check this. We can check out our perception with our good friends and teachers. And that means we're not left to our own devices just simply to figure something out, but actually share and deliberate and do our best. That's the best I can offer. So I think that's where we're going to close.